My name is Joshua Gibson, and you are listening to the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast, a show dedicated to promoting a message of critical thinking as it pertains to strength training, nutrition, and well-being. This is done through interviews with experts, high-level athletes, coaches, and people heavily involved in strength sports and athletic development. Pull up a chair, grab a coffee, and let's get on to today's podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast. I'm joined today by three, I guess you would say, titans in the field of strength and conditioning, weightlifting, things of that nature and of that study, sports science specifically. And kind of without going on, because I'm sure once they kind of introduce themselves, they'll be able to provide some context to that sentence. But I guess I'll start with Guy Hornsby. Guy, maybe you can introduce yourself. You were on a previous episode of the podcast where we talked specifically about periodization. But if people haven't listened to that, maybe you can kind of fill them in on your background before we introduce our other guests.
Yeah, thanks, Josh, for having me again. I'm looking forward to this one with the group discussion format. But so I did all three degrees with Dr. Stone at East Tennessee State University. I was a thrower for his wife, Meg, during undergrad, and Doc was my strength coach, and then really through grad school. So for about 6 years, I was a weightlifter for Doc, and much of my research was either, I guess all of it was generally strength power research, but then both my master's and dissertation were training studies. My dissertation was actually on weightlifters, and jump ahead just a little bit. I've been in Morgantown, West Virginia at West Virginia University since 2016. And I'm the head coach for WVU weightlifting, for West Virginia weightlifting is our USAW club, but we're a WVU sport club, and been able to continue doing strength power research with a focus on the sport of weightlifting, as well as I have sort of a sports science role through a partnership with WVU Athletics.
Yeah, awesome. Very succinct, very informative. And like I said, we did record another episode of the podcast where we went a little deeper into all of that stuff. So people are interested, they can search for that. And then, you know, some of the people who had really helped develop the education framework that people like Guy came out of. We have Dr. Kyle Pierce. Obviously doesn't need an introduction, but I reckon you should give one anyways, Kyle. Just a little bit about you and your involvement with weightlifting.
Thank you, Josh. Like Guy, Doc Stone was one of my professors. I got my doctorate under him at Auburn University, but we were at LSU before that. He was a professor and strength coach back in the late 1970s, and I was his graduate assistant there. But we met at a weightlifting competition, the Florida State Championships in Tampa in 1976. So we've been friends a long time, and I've been involved with, once I got into weightlifting in college, right when I got out, I started coaching. So it's been about 48 years I've been involved with coaching weightlifting.
Wow. That's something we can all aspire towards, is staying in weightlifting or just a single pursuit for that long and being able to develop. So yeah, that's great. And then the last guest, kind of rounding out the round table, no pun intended, is Dr. Mike Sohn. Dr. Mike, maybe you can talk a bit about your background and maybe you can go a little bit more in depth, because like I said, you haven't really been on many podcasts. I don't know how many people be familiar with the details of what you've done and where you've been.
Well, currently I'm the graduate coordinator and sports science lab director at East Tennessee State University. Obviously, my background is in strength and conditioning, and particularly weightlifting and track and field. I coached for a number of years, both track and field and weightlifting. I did a lot of strength coaching for Meg, my wife, who was a track and field coach. And, you know, we've continued on for years and years. And my primary interest is still strength and conditioning research, particularly with throwers and weightlifters.
How did you initially get into the field of strength and conditioning and then find yourself developing more of an interest in weightlifting, track and field, particularly field events?
Well, I lifted in my first weightlifting meet, I believe, in 1965. And I enjoyed that quite a bit. And but I became a thrower in college and continued weightlifting. And it's interesting because I started out wanting to, you know, go into biology. And I did. My undergraduate degree is in zoology, actually, and my master's degree is in biology. And that gave me a good background to move on into exercise and sports science, which I became quite interested in because of my background in sport. And I wanted to continue that and learn more about the underlying mechanisms that allow you to perform the way you do. And so I went from my undergraduate degree at what's now the University of Central Florida to Tennessee Tech for my master's degree, and then Florida State for my PhD. And all along the way, I met a number of people. In fact, a mentor for me and for Kyle Pierce, Dr. Bird, Ron Bird, we met him at Florida State. And he, you know, he encouraged both of us to continue on. And so meeting different people along the way really changes your life, so to speak. And of course, Kyle and Guy and my wife, Meg, who was a two-time Olympian discus thrower in 80 and 84. And, you know, working with her in track and field and having been a thrower, there was an obvious interest there for me in terms of throwing. And then with my weightlifting background, an obvious interest there. I had been a strength coach at LSU and at Auburn, and working with a basketball team at Auburn. And so it was a natural outgrowth. You know, my background plus my academic pursuits. And as I say, you meet a lot of people along the way that really influence you. And of course, both Kyle and Guy have been paramount in influencing me, along with my wife, Meg. And so here we are today.
And I'm kind of curious to hear your take on how you were able to help the sports science scene or the field of sports science in the U.S., if you want to kind of talk about it like that, given kind of the paucity of research that was available, the resources. I mean, I tend to think that you wrote, you know, one of the more like impactful books called Principles and Practice of Resistance Training. Like I said off air, it was one of the only textbooks initially that I had read cover to cover because it was just so informative. But in a field that was kind of barren initially, I think it's developed with time. How were you able to operate and help the field develop as you went? Was it just something that happened naturally? Did you make a concerted effort to try and develop kind of the sports science field in the U.S.? Like, what was your approach when you started, and how do you think you've done over the decades?
Well, that's an interesting question. In the United States, there really wasn't a whole lot of sports science, nor were there a lot of people dedicated to sports science until just recently. You know, there were a few people here and there that would do studies with athletes once in a while, but there really was no integrated sports science with sports, you know, day to day to day. And one of the things that really helped me understand that was my wife Meg took a job as the national track and field coach for Scotland. And we moved to Scotland, and I became professor and chair of sport at Edinburgh University. And part of my function was to work directly with Sports Scotland, which is the equivalent of the USOC. And I really got an education there about how sports science should work. The idea is that it's not just once in a while you do a research project. You start working day to day with the people. And then when we came back to the United States, both of us went to work for the USOC. And I met Bill Sands and Randy Wilburn and some other people out there. And it became even more obvious that sports science in the United States was lagging behind a good part of the world. And so Meg had an interest in getting back into coach education and coaching some too. And I wanted to get back into research, and we both had an idea of how sports science might work. And so we found jobs here at East Tennessee, and we developed it into the program that we have now, where we have our students integrated with the athletic department. Students work directly with teams, and so we have sort of an integration between the practical side and the academic side, and it's worked pretty well so far.
Yeah, and I think we just kind of focused on a really abbreviated development of sports science in the U.S. Now, the paper that you three worked on is about youth weightlifting. It's a narrative review. Kyle, maybe you can discuss the development of, or as you know, through your lens, what youth weightlifting has looked like over the time you've been involved in the sport. And maybe you can talk about if it's changed at all, the perception of getting youth involved, or what that was like earlier on, if it was taboo, if it was kind of commonplace, because we know that in other countries, they start kids off very early. They handpick kids to put into programs, and then they start their training. So quite a bit different from the U.S. Maybe you can talk about it through your lens.
Well, it has changed. I think people are more receptive. It's obvious for both resistance training and for the sport of weightlifting. Though there's still some of those myths that are out there about, you know, particular stunning of growth and such, and that kids shouldn't do anything until they're fully mature. And it's true in other countries, that they do start the children at an early age, but there's also in other countries too that some of those myths exist even more than in our country, as far as the kids and particularly with women and starting weightlifting. But it has changed. People are a lot more receptive, a lot more information out there.
Yeah. And then how long have you been working with youth weightlifters? Like, what was the point at which you started developing, you know, people or kids that were around, you know, 10, 11 years old through their athletic lifespan?
I mean, I started, you know, once I learned, I was got out of college and went back home, and I worked for the recreation department. My official job was the janitor at a rec center. That was my first job out of college, but I was doing other things. I was working with kids. I remember making a little barbell out of PVC pipe and some foam rubber and painted it up like the old York plates that were metal on the inside with the rubber on the outside out of red and blue and all that, and teaching kids back in, you know, that was like 1974, 75. But, and I did it through the years. I coached high school football and track and had weightlifting, you know, kids weightlifting there at the college and, or at the high school. And, you know, through the years I worked with kids, but, when I came to LSU Shreveport in 1990, started getting some things going, hosting some meets. And, I left here, to go work at the NSCA in Colorado Springs, but came back when, I worked with the city of Shreveport to bid on a development center here through USA Weightlifting. And, Shreveport was awarded that. Didn't mean I was automatically the coach. That was another process, but they chose me because I had been here. And so that was in about 97 that happened. And that's when I first, you know, we first, you know, really started getting some kids together that, you know, went on to make world teams and Olympic teams and things like that.
Were your perceptions, you know, obviously we talked about it being taboo to some extent, and you mentioned reasons why. If you came out of college and almost immediately started working in a recreation center and working with kids, did you have any perception that resistance training or weightlifting would be, I mean, I would assume not if you work with them, but like negatively impacting them in any way? Like when did... I guess a better question was, when were you able to match the evidence up with practice so you could say, hey, like this is perfectly fine. There's no reason to worry, because it seemed like you had an inclination earlier on to in practice work with youth athletes.
I mean, I read as much as I could back then, you know, and like Dr. Stone, I mean, I was, I took an interest in weightlifting. I always say I was one of the worst athletes ever. It took me 5 years to get a half scholarship in football, and it was because I got involved with weightlifting. There's no doubt, and I wanted to learn more about that and how I could, you know, help other people, you know, perform better, to train better, for better performance. So, I mean, not formally education wise, I was reading everything I could. I remember I'd read those anything that came out. Some of the weightlifting manuals, the Russian manuals, and was reading as much as I could about training, you know, athletes as well as, you know, developing kids. And that's why I went back and got my master's and started on my doctorate right after that to try to learn more about that. And that was one of my specific interests was, you know, how to teach, how to do it properly.
And then, Guy, maybe you can kind of follow up on that with anything that you happen to see, social media, or even with, you know, the athletes you work with, if people still carry a lot of those preconceived notions that, you know, weightlifting or resistance training shouldn't be carried out until a certain age, and it's for developmental reasons or for, you know, some other host of reasons, like, you can talk about maybe its prevalence and then what those myths are that people tend to propagate.
Yeah. Two things come to mind. So the first is I'm a little bit younger than Dr. Pearson and Dr. Stone. And I would say since I've been coaching and quite honestly, so we, as a weightlifting coach, we do have some, I've had several high school lifters. I've even had a handful that would have been in middle school when they started. We've had, you know, the last couple of years, we've had weightlifters competed, youth nationals, junior nationals, and that. But by far, more of my experience with resistance training and developmental athletes is I oversee a contract that's through the county school board here in Monongalia County, and it allows us to provide strength and conditioning to those three high schools. So we have a graduate assistant funded head strength coach for each of the three high schools, and so I've been doing that. This is year five for that endeavor, and I would say, you know, thinking back to when I was middle school, high school, I came from a sports situation in Louisiana in middle school, where a lot of the athletes, all the sports I was involved in, lifted weights, and then my parents were just generally interested in fitness and would go to the gym. And in fact, my dad way back was a graduate student and a weightlifter for Dr. Stone at LSU. And so I actually remember back then, like a handful of times going to see a physician for like just an annual checkup or my physical or something like that, and being told, "Oh, you're lifting weights, you shouldn't do that." I have not seen that same type of those myths about stunting growth and those types of things. I know that I've heard from other people that those things do still exist, but I don't think, at least from what I'm seeing, that they're as prevalent as they used to be. I would say more generally, probably the bigger issues with resistance exercise and youth and adolescent is ages is that getting more into the broader scope of long-term athlete development. And some of the things I see, I would say not just with the high schools here, but, you know, from talking to a whole lot of other people that are working with younger athletes in a weight room setting, I think that, you know, there are some really good recommendations that come from, you know, various NGBs, position statements from various organizations like NSCA. But something I always think about when I'm, you know, I thought a ton about it when we were working on this paper that just came out. But when I go through and I read a lot of the typical LTAD stuff that gets into, you know, all the things we've seen of, ideas on early specialization, being careful with, you know, sort of neglecting the training for the sport and going right to just competing or doing the sport all the time, rushing things, pressuring young athletes too quickly, too soon. I think there's a whole lot of good information out there, but I do feel that sometimes the recommendations that come from that, or sometimes in the U.S., you know, Doc alluded to sort of us lagging behind a bit when it comes to sports science. I would say, in, you know, compared to some other places, we've lagged behind in more of a just good approach to overall training process. And I think sometimes some of the recommendations are, if this makes sense, workarounds for poor coaching, and maybe just workarounds for some of the not great systems we have in place within the U.S. So whether it's the travel and club sports, and just to sort of summarize this so I don't go on for too long, I think for weightlifting, for example, I definitely think there's important considerations in terms of, you know, biological and chronological ages. What's the motivation of the athlete? Is the young athlete, you know, what do they want to do? What have they done before? All of those things. But I think that a weightlifter can, if they choose, if they really want to, they can specialize in weightlifting. And as a weightlifting coach, it's our responsibility to guide that training process in an appropriate manner. And so sometimes, for example, I think there's recommendations about being multi-sport athlete, which I certainly appreciate athletes, you know, in middle school, high school, being involved in multiple sports. But I think that it's our responsibility as coaches to, you know, if it's an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, not train them like they're in their 20s and been training and competing in weightlifting for 10 plus years. We can expose them to various movement patterns and types of training and start more general. And so, you know, hopefully that's just a kind of quick example of, you know, that often I think workaround of, you know, expose them to different things. And I do think there's benefits, especially when they're younger, to being exposed to different sports. But I think that at the core of it, at the core of LTAD, needs to be really good coach education and really good, well thought out coaching.
No, that's perfect. And I think that allows, you know, a lot of context to segue us into kind of the flip side of that question. So, Dr. Stone, maybe you can discuss the benefits of resistance training in youth and adolescent populations, given we kind of know that some whispers of myths exist regarding the negative effects. Maybe we can start with the physical kind of performance. I guess we'd start with the physical, but the physical benefits of resistance training from a young age.
Well, there are a number of reasons to get involved with resistance training. The obvious one is in terms of sport and how it may influence your ability to perform. If you're stronger and more powerful and you've done things correctly, that tends to transfer into sporting activities. And, you know, there's no doubt that to an extent coaches have recognized that, because if you go around, you know, high school and college weight rooms, there's weight rooms dedicated just to sport. And almost every team now trains with, at least some of the time, with resistance training equipment, usually free weights. And so one of the obvious benefits is it's transfer to sport. Increases in strength, increases in power output, rate of force development, alterations in body composition, and so on. We can argue about how they do that and whether they're doing the best job at it. And that may be an important factor, whether they're really able to integrate the resistance training into the overall training process is, you know, generally in the United States, arguable as to whether they're really meeting the criteria for good integration. From a health standpoint, there are many, many reasons to get involved with resistance training. The changes in body composition, bone mineral density increases, and you know, alterations in metabolism and so on. In fact, several people recently have made arguments that weight training may be as beneficial or more beneficial than aerobic training, and certainly the combination of the two is might be optimum. But nevertheless, when you think about degenerative diseases that begin to, in a sense, attack you later in life, diabetes, heart disease, and so on, and osteoporosis, which occurs both in men and women, there's good reason to take up resistance training early on and continue through. There is also good data from several different studies indicating that stronger people live longer. Not only that, but they live with a better quality of life. there's data coming out of Phillips Lab and so on down the line that strongly indicate that the use of resistance training as a, you might term it, a health intervention is extremely beneficial.
And obviously we'll get into the practical implementation of this stuff a little later, but I think, you know, when, you know, most people kind of think about youth resistance training, they think, they almost imagine that the youth have like different machinery, and obviously it depends, you know, at what point those kids are along the developmental kind of like lifespan, to what sort of changes we'll see. But at the heart of it, are there much differences between, you know, the adaptations within like a youth athlete and then the adaptations within an athlete that is older, in their 20s? You know, obviously there are small considerations, but are they as large as we sometimes make them out to be?
Depends on how young you're talking about. I mean, if you, before puberty, there are probably fewer changes in the muscle system. You know, you're still developing your nervous system and so on. There are changes that occur. There's no doubt. A lot of it also deals with what type of resistance training program are you engaged in. And that can have a big impact on the outcome, just as it does in adults. But typically, when you go through the literature, what you find is in pre-pubertal children, the changes in body composition and so on are a little bit less. They still get changes in strength, not quite as much. And then when they hit puberty, there's some acceleration to that. Again, it depends upon, and I think several people, you know, Guy and Kyle have touched on this, it depends on how you introduce resistance training to those children. And obviously, as Guy pointed out, if you're dealing with a 8-year-old, you're not going to introduce, or you shouldn't introduce, the same kind of training that you would with a 20-year-old. And a lot of those reasons, you're basically dealing with not a small adult, but a child. And so their developmental level is not the same. Now, having said that, there are things that you can do that will, in a sense, put them ahead of the game. But one thing I would caution you about is pushing these kids too hard. For example, it's interesting, there is data that suggests that among athletes, for example, most elite adolescents, for example, do not make it to elite senior athletes. And one of the reasons for that is not simply developmental from the genetic standpoint, but the way they were coached and trained. In other words, they were pushed too hard too early. And so they what we find among those elite junior athletes is a higher incidence of burnout, a higher incidence of injury, particularly overuse injury early on, and they begin to drop out of the sport. So it's quite important that you introduce the training program appropriately for the age group. And as Guy also alluded to, an important factor is chronological age versus biological age, because they're not the same thing.
And then, so I think we did a good job of covering kind of the physical or physiological changes. Kyle, maybe you can discuss, you know, the kind of the psychosocial changes from you know, a theoretical perspective, just seeing the changes that occur, you know, in research, but also in practice when you would, you know, work with youth athletes. Had you noticed a distinct change, maybe in their kind of perception of the self or the way they handled things, you know, from that psychological slash social perspective?
Yeah, I think that's why I love to coach youth weightlifting. It's just to see those kids, you know, develop, you know, build that self-confidence and self-esteem. And sometimes that carries over to, you know, other parts of their lives and school and social situations. It's always great to hear parents talk about, yeah, my son or my daughter, they stand more upright. They got more confidence, you know, and we've talked about, I've seen kids that were like real shy and quiet. And we joke that, you know, we got them out of their shell and sometimes we wish we could get them back in it. But, you know, it's just wonderful. And there's research to support that. Way back, Larry Tucker, who was with us at Auburn, did several studies showing about, you know, the self-esteem and strength training. And I just, in addition to the research that you see, I've just observed it. It's interesting. Yesterday, I went to see a friend of mine. He is a retired English professor from Centenary University College named Earl Labor. And Earl's 93 now. And he's wrote English textbooks. He's a biographer of Jack London. And he was a weightlifter back in the 1940s and 50s and into the 60s. And I go visit him and we talk about everything, but we talk about weightlifting. He brought up even yesterday about, you know, what a wonderful feeling that was and the confidence that it gave you, you know, when he first started getting into the sport of weightlifting there. So, you know, I love that. When we started this development center that I talked about in 97, 98, our goal was to develop athletes to compete for the U.S. at, you know, world championships and Olympic games and such. And I feel we accomplished that. But, you know, even more so, I felt that, you know, a major goal is to build that confidence in those kids, you know. You know, you can only have a few that reach the top, but, you know, you can, you know, every kid can improve their self-confidence if it's done right. And we mentioned in the paper about it needs to be done right, because there's situations where kids may come in the gym and they may be, you know, they may lose that confidence if it's done improperly. So it's just not automatic that you start lifting weights and you're in a situation with a coach there and that you're going to develop that, you know, positive self-esteem. You know, I think it could be the other way around. So it has to, it's not just that weight training, weightlifting builds that confidence if it needs to be properly implemented. Mm-hmm.
And then, Guy, maybe you can follow that up. So we talked about the physical benefits, the psychosocial benefits, but as far as actually determining if it's appropriate for, you know, a child or youth, how would our listeners, because I think of this podcast as a useful resource that people can send around to help inform people who maybe are unfamiliar or want to know more, people who are thinking, well, my kid seems like they're old enough to get involved, but they're unsure. What's a good way to start gauging when it's appropriate for kids to begin like formal resistance training, formal weightlifting training?
So I think that, like Doc mentioned, with the biological versus chronological, I think that is part of it. And so, you know, you could, it's probably better to give a age range. And I would say, you know, getting into middle school or, you know, 10, 11, you I think an important word you used there was formal, because I think that, you know, there's a difference between we're going to start showing up to the weight room and going to be, you know, we're going to have a training plan. We're going to have a coach carry out that plan with that young athlete. Because before that, you could start doing things well before that, body weight exercises. One of the things in our coaching program we talk we go over with students is, you know, before, in most places, before high school, there, and admittedly, not enough even high schools have a qualified strength coach in a nice weight room situation, but let's say they're in an area where they do. Before high school, most of the situations of athletes being with coaches, right, is sport coaches. And so we actually go over with them how to, you know, if you're working with, it could be third graders, fourth graders, how do you, as part of your soccer practice, do some body weight exercises? You know, what are things that would be appropriate to include? Movement development, those types of things. My daughter she'll be 5 in March, and she's been doing gymnastics for 2 years. So certainly there's some, you know, body weight resistance type exercises involved there. Getting into the more formal situation, I think that, you know, that age of around middle school is appropriate, as, you know, making some assumptions of biological age, but not just biological age, in terms of the physical. But I think a really important component to this is, you know, Kyle mentioned the confidence and sort of that gets at, I think, some of the coach responsibility of creating a good environment, developing a good relationship with the athlete and all that. But even before that, I think it's important that the athlete actually wants to be there. And, you know, there's different versions of that. It might be that they think they maybe are kind of interested and want to check it out. They, you know, to be quite honest, when I was in middle school, very quickly, I wanted to be going to the gym. And so I didn't really need convinced of that. And so I think in that type of situation, you could probably, as a coach, you know, identify, okay, this person, you know, they clearly want to be here. And Doc's, you know, I've heard Doc give examples of really talented lifters that ended up achieving a lot of success. He's mentioned Nam Sulamalu at like 12 and 13, the coaches clearly seeing he wanted to be in there and was more serious than everyone else. It wasn't just, you know, he clearly also had tons and tons of talent, but he wanted to be there. And I think that the them wanting to be there is really important. And then from there, I think that just a general recommendation is, you know, I think that the words, you know, like foundational movements and you know, sort of the ABCs of LTAD, when you're specifically working with the weightlifting situation, don't just, I guess the best way to put it would be, don't skip ahead. You know, even if, you know, some kids will, like, to give like a basketball free throw analogy, if you take 10 kids and you line them up at the free throw line and have them shoot free throws, there might be a one or two that do things without being told that you're looking for correctly, and then the rest of them don't. Still teach all of them correctly, and give them feedback, tell them the things that they're doing properly. If they need some corrective instruction, provide that. And then also, you know, let's say to get into more weightlifting specific movements, like whether it's a pulling movement or a squatting movement, whatever it may be, really take your time, teach, not just address issues, but also reinforce things from a, you know, they're learning the motor patterns, but also I think they want to be aware of them, consciously. And so I think some of the not rushing things is breaking down the pull, breaking down squatting movements, providing good feedback. And when you know, Doc said, don't rush things, they don't need to be ready to compete as quickly as possible. And it's that approach is not the best way to do it. So really, really take your time. I think another good approach is to put together the training to where a lot of times they're learning technique without realizing they're learning technique. And don't just look at it as you're learning technique right now. It's strength training. Right. And so there's so many good examples of athletes get stronger and their technique gets better. And, you know, force is a vector. So we can't exactly always, it's not always obvious, you know, this technique improved because it was more the direction of the forces, you know, the more motor pattern type stuff that we would put under this was a technique enhancement. Or was it, well, they produce more force now. And so those things go hand in hand. And a lot of times we'll see athletes improve in technique along with them getting stronger. And I would assume in many cases, especially in younger lifters, yes, I'm sure some of it is that their motor patterns have improved, but then also it's they're stronger and that helps them perform the movement better.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to summarize it. And it kind of reminds me of those food items you'll see at the grocery store that say hidden vegetables. It's like macaroni and cheese with hidden peas and carrots. And you always try to sneak those in. But as far as the performance aspect of all this, Dr. Mike, maybe you can talk a bit about any performance detriment that we would see if kids weren't trained early enough. So I'm not sure if there are any windows of development where there may be more able to adapt and be influenced by the training. And maybe we're starting to look at the period of puberty and beyond, but if, you know, adolescents aren't exposed to training early enough, saying they want to specialize in a sport later on, or maybe with weightlifting, are they missing out on some sort of like heightened development?
Well, there is general agreement that if children don't develop what's typically termed physical literacy early on, usually by the age of 11 or 12, that they're going to have difficulty with some aspects of sport. And that physical literacy includes obviously walking and jumping, but things like galloping, skipping, throwing, those types of things need to be learned, you know, fairly early on. As I say, typically by the age of 11 or 12, if you haven't accomplished those, you may never accomplish those. And pretty much everybody agrees on that. There is the idea of critical ages, and that is that at certain periods in your lifetime, you are more likely to adapt to certain stimuli than others. For example, there's some information to suggest that between the ages of 11 and 12, that if you're exposed to sprinting, you may gain some advantages to that. However, that idea is very controversial as to whether it really works or not. There is also quite a bit of information dealing with what's called peak height velocity, which typically occurs around the time of puberty. And a lot of sports scientists that deal with long-term athlete development measure peak height velocity. They track that. And once you get into the peak height velocity, then you can start making application of some of the, you know, higher intensity movements, resistance, you know, heavier resistance training loads and so on. And as I say, there's now quite a bit of information. Marco Cardinal from Aspire has done a lot with that. And it's pretty interesting research. An important factor, again, is if the child is actually interested in a sport, are they doing things in training that are really going to transfer to that sport? And so the training program itself becomes extremely important, even early on. And again, I want to emphasize, though, that early on, and I know Kyle and Guy and I have talked about this a lot, you know, how much should you push these kids to really excel when they're like 11, 12 years old, 13 years old? Is that really a good idea? And I suspect that it's probably not. I think it, you know, you should really concentrate more on the developmental aspects of the training program at that point.
Yeah. And Dr. Pierce, maybe you can talk about kind of, you know, if people are following along with the paper, start to get into how to instill the right technique or the proper technique so that these things can be loaded effectively over time to either maximize the return if we're looking at it from a performance perspective, or to maximize weight lifted if we're looking at it from an actual like performance in weightlifting perspective. So kind of the sports versus weightlifting approach. So if you're dealing with a youth athlete, what's the strategy you use to teach the technical movements, snatch, clean, jerk, squat, and does the approach vary based on the movement, or is it all kind of the same sequence of introducing them and then teaching them?
I mean, in general, we followed what's been advocated, you know, in the past. You know, things have changed by USA Weightlifting and IWF with more of a top-down approach to teaching over time. Though we have used, you know, sort of things from the bottom up and sort of put them together there as well. And so that's what we've used over the years. Of course, we spend quite a bit of time in each of those phases. Had a guy visit us years ago who developed an instrument called the V-Scope, Gennady Hiskia. And Gennady came here back in, you know, like 1998 when we first started this development center. And he came to teach us how to use the V-Scope, but he wanted to talk about training. And he talked about, you know, kids being able to use the hips and legs. And he felt that they ought to work from sort of a power position there at the mid upper thigh for 2 years before they did anything else. And I indicated that, you know, that might work in other places, but, you know, our kids wanted to get into some form of competition. And so, you know, we sort of, you know, compromised really with our training. I think in a paper we cited in this recent article that was called What Young Weightlifters Performance Across Time, we tracked lifters, these kids, for several years, and about 70% of their lifts were from that power position there in those first 2 years. So we really worked on developing the hips and legs in the second pull there, and slowly integrated the other phases. We weren't in any hurry there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then how, like I've worked with younger athletes, youth, and they're really incentivized. They kind of incentivize themselves to lift well, to put on more weight. And when you're teaching a movement that's really technically driven and requires a lot of kind of scrutiny to make sure it's done well, how do you align the speed at which the kid wants to move with the speed at which their technique wants to move?
I mean, you got to go with the technique. You can't rush it. And it's not only the kids that want to, may not be the kids that want to, progress rapidly. It's oftentimes their parents remember the Junior Olympics event one year, the kids did really well. And one of the parents came to me and he said, you know, we've all been talking, all the parents, and we think you're holding our kids back. I said, you know what? You're absolutely right. And so, we didn't always in competitions. I mean, that's where it comes in, where the coach can make competitions. You know, they can pick the weights, and they can pick weights that ensure success at that early age, you know, and again, build that confidence up. So if they're going to competitions and making all the lifts early on, you know, and as they develop and they get older and go to bigger competitions, you know, they've got that background where they feel like every time they step on that competition platform, they're going to make that lift. So it's hard. I mean, it's difficult to, you know, sometimes to be patient and not push the kids too hard, but, you know, you've got to do that. And sometimes you've got to, the parents can be your, they can be your greatest allies, but sometimes they may want to interfere a little bit. So you got to sort of shut that down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you mentioned competition there, and, you know, it not only is a way to help kind of benchmark where the athlete's at, but Guy, maybe you can talk about the benefits of competition. If, you know, obviously if the kid wants to be involved, mm-hmm. The benefits of competing, the benefits in being involved in some sort of organized process leading to kind of like an endpoint. Maybe for people who are listening, maybe they're on the fence about either getting their kids involved or they're on the fence about competing themselves, because I think this is just kind of a general takeaway, but what the purpose and positives could be of competing in the sport of weightlifting.
Yeah. That's a good question. Real quick though, if I could tell a story.
Sure.
With Kyle with Kendrick Ferris. This was before Kendrick had become an Olympian, and I want to say Kyle, he broke the American record in the clean and jerk in 2006 at the American Open in Alabama, Birmingham, I believe. And Doc, myself, and my roommate at the time, who's now a strength coach, actually here with us at WVU, Jared Burton, we made the trip down from John City. It was not that long of a drive. And I remember the day before Kendrick competed and did, I believe 198 was that American record. Kyle basically told us that this meet, assuming the openers went well, that and actually I think it was snatch goes well, opener clean and jerk goes well. I think it was around low 190s. You referred to sort of taking the brakes off. Mm-hmm. And I want to say Kendrick would have been around that time, 18, 19, something like that, but had been training under Kyle since 6-7 years, maybe even longer prior to that. And so, you know, I think when you're thinking about parents and you know, wanting to win the youth nationals or concerned about placing it at youth and sometimes even juniors, it's trying to get across the importance of having the long-term plan. And it's not, you know, we're not going to hold you back forever. It's purposeful. But there's good reasons at times to do that, especially early on. But as far as competing goes, let's assume that, the athlete is ready to compete. I think there's a couple of things. I think one, sometimes, if the coach feels that they're ready or close, let's say, sometimes just going through that process of preparing for a meet can be a valuable experience for a young weightlifter. And if this makes sense, I think that after they compete, they now feel like I'm a weightlifter. You know, they could be in a gym setting with weightlifters performing weightlifting movements, doing snatches and clean and jerks, and until they compete, they don't have that feeling of, I really am a weightlifter. To share another story, I was lucky enough to have Carissa and Jason Gump, Carissa Olympian in 2008, Jason a fantastic lifter in his own right. In fact, as far as I can tell, maybe the best weightlifter born and raised in the state of West Virginia. So they visited the gym, and both of them started weightlifting and did just, I mean, really chose to do just weightlifting at young ages. And I was particularly interested in Jason's story because he's only from about 45 minutes from here. And what he said was he competed and he did very well when he was, I think, 12, 13, somewhere around there, and pretty quickly was doing very well at youth nationals. And that experience led to him deciding to not do other sports. It was his decision. He decided not to do football, even though they were begging him to do football. And he, you know, he, after he won youth nationals, it was, I want to make a youth Pan Ams, which he, I believe, eventually made. I don't know if it was youth Pan Ams or junior Pan Ams. It was one of the two. But you know, there's you can sort of see the light turn on, so to speak, after that first competition. They more identify as being an athlete in that sport. They understand a bit more of what it means to compete. And there's, you know, there's levels to it. The first local meet, the first national meet. You know, I think Kyle could talk some about, he does some pretty cool stuff with sort of like mock meets for real young kids to introduce them to some things. He's told me, you know, he wears the IWF jacket and they get referees to judge the lifts there. And, you know, there's local, we can picture local meets, right, that are a bit more, what's a nice way of putting it, sort of bare bones, mm-hmm. versus local meets, where it's one of the reasons why we annually take the kids down to East Tennessee State for Docs meet, because it's a much more professionally done, official feeling meet. And there's reasons to do those different types of meets. ETSU isn't always probably the best first meet for everybody. And so, you know, I don't think you should compete all the time, but you probably also, like Kyle mentioned, with the patience level of not just parents, that's part of it, but also kids, right? In the U.S., their friends are competing in, you know, if they're in team sports, they're just constantly competing and they see that. And so, I think it's at some point you need to compete.
Yeah, that's, I think it adds a lot of richness to the experience. As you mentioned, it kind of like satisfies that final criteria of being a weightlifter once you've taken six lifts on a competition platform with a referee watching. And I guess, Dr. Mike, I know that sports science, you know, a large part of that is focusing on research surrounding athlete monitoring. So how can you best monitor the athlete to know kind of how much fatigue there is, what their kind of level of performance is, what they're capable of doing, and how much work they should be doing with youth athletes? Is that kind of a consideration, any sort of athlete monitoring or just monitoring in general to track changes over time, or maybe, you know, between sessions or within sessions, is there a reason to get granular with the monitoring of the training of youth athletes?
If they're an athlete, they should be monitored. There's really two aspects to monitoring. There's fatigue management and there's program efficacy. In a sense, the day-to-day, week-to-week, you know, how fatigued the athlete becomes obviously is going to influence their ability to adapt and eventually compete. And so some of what you're going to be doing in the monitoring program is going to deal with those fatigue elements. And that could range from subjective input from the athlete, you know, questionnaires and so on, recovery questionnaires, to, depending on how much money you've got, blood work, but rate of force development and weighted jumps. In fact, Dr. Hornsby, in one of his studies, showed pretty clearly that jumping, particularly with a slight load on the bar, gives you a pretty good idea of the fatigue level of the athlete. And it's not particularly fatiguing in itself to do a few jumps with, you know, 20, 40 kilos on the bar. And so keeping track of that, but rate of, in terms of fatigue, basically the nervous system becomes involved very quickly. And with fatigue, there are two aspects that show up right off the bat if you're not careful. And one is a decrement in their technique, and that's been shown to occur in weightlifting. The other one is an alteration in rate of force development, how fast you can produce force. And that begins to deteriorate quite quickly. And so keeping track of those things can help you in terms of fatigue. But also you want to keep track of program efficacy. In other words, is what you're doing in training really working? So again, you would measure all kinds of things from body composition. You know, if you've got the equipment, you can measure muscle thickness through ultrasound. You can measure their strength levels a number of different ways. One that's relatively non-fatiguing is an isometric mid-thigh pull, which we use quite a bit. And you don't even have to go very far with it. Just a 1 second pull, as much as you can, will give you a great amount of information. In terms of their maximum strength level, their rate of force development, and so on down the line. And so those two things put together should be instituted with every athlete. Now, if you don't have a lot of, you know, if you don't have the funds, it's hard to buy force plates and so on down the line. But almost everybody can invest in a switch mat. And with a switch mat, you can measure vertical jumps quite easily, including weighted vertical jumps. And you can create, for example, a low jump height curve. So you have the athlete start out with essentially nothing, a PVC pipe on the, you know, held on their shoulders like a squat. They jump with that, and then they go up in incremental loads, depending on the level of the athlete, maybe up to 100, 120 kilograms. And you get essentially a force velocity curve there. And you can track that over time, and you're hoping it's going to move up and to the right. In other words, they can jump higher with a given load. And so those types of things can be instituted pretty cheap. And that should be done with those athletes. Another factor that can be done pretty cheap, and this goes back to fatigue management to a great extent. When the athlete comes in to the training hall before they start, have them sit down for about 5 or 10 minutes, you know, hopefully in a quiet room. Take their heart rate, take their blood pressure, and track that. One of the things that we found is if an athlete is steadily losing a weight, even in small increments over a period of about a week, and their heart rate's going up, they're in trouble 100% of the time. And it's time to change your workout. But there are other aspects. For example, if all of a sudden their blood pressure gets quite high and so on, not only is that a health concern, but it might deal with poor fatigue management. In other words, they're simply too tired. Another type of thing that you can do is have them sit, take their blood pressure sitting down, and then stand up and take their blood pressure standing up immediately. If you get a pretty substantial fall in blood pressure, again, that may, orthostatic hypotension, it's called, that may deal with, poor fatigue management, and it's time to back off. So there are some things that you can do that are pretty cost effective that can pay dividends in the long run. And then obviously taking a good hard look at your training program. Is it are you using a periodization program? How are you programming it? Have you got heavy and light days built in? Have you got unload weeks built in? And so on. And those may be particularly important in youth weightlifting. So the monitoring aspect is extremely important for all levels of athlete, but I think particularly for these kids.
And with the kind of like rising popularity and velocity-based training, but also tracking velocity over time using some sort of like linear position transducer or accelerometer, do you think there's any reason to invest in one of those devices, given that the costs have come down quite a bit and it's minimally invasive? You just hook it onto a bar and track speeds over time.
Yeah, well, there's all kinds of problems with that. If you actually get in, I know velocity-based training has become pretty popular, but if you actually get into the literature, it's not very reliable, at least based on what we know now. The most important thing is, in most of the time, move the bar as fast as you can with good technique. But velocity-based training is shaky at best, I promise. And there's some good reviews of the literature that have come out in the last couple of years that pretty much show. There's no reason to believe that using percentage based training doesn't work just as well, and in many cases better. The other thing about the linear position transducers, if you only have one and it's on one side of the barbell, you're asking for even more reliability problems, because many lifters do not pull the bar symmetrically. So one side of the bar may be rising a little bit faster than the other side. And then also, most lifters have some twist in it. So one side of the bar may be moving forward while the other side moves back. And that introduces some horizontal movement, which is not always picked up by one linear position transducer. You actually need two on each side to really deal with those horizontal movements. And so if you're using weightlifting movements and you put the transducer on the floor and it's linear, you're going to have several problems. One is the bar is moving differently than your center of mass is moving, and differently than the center of system mass is moving. Plus you're introducing some horizontal movement that can interfere with some of your calculations in terms of velocity and displacement and so on. Something like a squat or a partial movement, and you might get some reasonable results, but it's very difficult. So I wouldn't recommend velocity-based training right now, other than to move the bar as fast as you can.
And then Kyle, maybe you could kind of help wrap us up. So when you started working with younger athletes, youth athletes, and then kind of looking forward to having produced, very, very high, very, very successful weightlifters, is there anything you wish you would have known about working with kids that you kind of have picked up over time, be it like how to make sure training is fun, interesting, how to manage just like youth personalities. Is there anything that, you know, our listeners could take away from this if they start working with younger athletes, or if they work with younger athletes now and just want to refine their approach?
Well, it was a process. I mean, you'd asked me earlier about when I started, and I told you, I mentioned I tried to, you know, learn as much as I could. And of course, I wish I knew then what I knew now, but it took time. I'm still trying to learn things. That, you know, it's an ongoing process there. I think it's important for coaches to learn about, you know, the science behind sport as much as they can. Not everybody's going to be in a situation to go to the university, but I'm so thankful that I was able to do that and, you know, study physiology and study biomechanics and study psychology and motor learning, motor development, and, you know, all those things that, you know, are so important, you know, to me as a coach, to be able to draw from that knowledge of you know, just in particular with working with kids of the motor development there. And so I think it's important to try to learn as much as you can. I know there's a lot of information out there, but not all of it's good, you know, and anything you can get that's more evidence-based, more research-based is much better than somebody's opinion. It's not true in every case, but in most cases, you know, I try to seek out, you know, evidence-based information on training kids there. And I just wish I'd had all that, you know, early on, just given to me. It took me time to gather up a lot of that information.
Yeah, and we're grateful that you were able to help put together something that now exists in the body of evidence as a resource. So if people want to read it, obviously we'll include it in the show notes, but they can read the review and then they can kind of inform themselves and help inform others. And Guy, as someone who, you know, helped put together this review, do you see any gaps in the literature that you'd like to see filled, or the things you'd like to know more about to better inform coaches when they do train youth athletes?
Yeah, I think if I had to pick an area, and this is a pretty big area, broad, I should say, there's much more information, particularly on not just weightlifters, but even just athletes, anaerobic strength power athletes, when it comes to training in the weight room, adaptations that are brought about by that training in, you know, particularly college age athletes and up. And I think that being able to, and there's there's some very good references that even go a good ways back that Doc mentioned, Ron Bird, where there are some studies, there's a couple that deal with younger weightlifters. But I think that we could definitely, we need more studies that kind of look more closely at the training process for younger athletes, and particularly for younger weightlifters. And to give an example, there was recently, I don't know if you have seen this, the paper by Bush et al. It's called Early Sport Specialization in Elite Weightlifters, Weightlifting Injury Occurrence and Relevant Opinions in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. It was a survey study where they sent a survey out to the top 20 weightlifters in each weight class, so eight male, seven female. And then they break down, they give some important, some helpful information, I think, in terms of they ask the athletes when they specialized, you know, at what age, what level, they asked them some stuff about injuries. They asked some questions on whose decision was it to specialize, was it them or the coach? And I think that, you know, studies like this can be helpful, but I think that at the kind of like what I was saying up front about LTAD, and it's so important that we have good coach education and good coaching. It's really important to look at what those, not those, when I say those, like this, the lifters in this particular study, but just more generally young developing weightlifters, and, you know, just looking at some things like how successful were they, what was their injury situation, what was their specialization situation, all of those things, it can be helpful. But I think that we could use some more detail, right? What are weightlifters doing? What is the training process? And look at, and the, you know, from there we can learn hopefully better how to develop young weightlifters. Because I think that anyone would agree probably that there are better and not as good ways to do that. And so, you know, there are plenty of examples of weightlifters specializing early. And when I say, you know, achieving success, I mean, you know, making an Olympic team. That doesn't mean that that's what everyone should do. But also giving an example of someone that you know, God forbid, suffers an injury, was pushed too hard too soon. You know, you could specialize and be specialized early at 13, 14, and get hurt by the time you're 15, 16, or your performance could stagnate before you get out of the junior level. Or you could, you know, there's some examples of weightlifters specializing and they were brought about slowly and developed well and you know, it didn't have a major in their teens. And continue to develop a competition
platform. Yeah.
Oh!
Well, luckily, I think that's pretty much a perfect place to wrap up, you know, besides the plugs towards the end. So maybe we can fit those in. And Dr. Stone, I know that you don't have an incredibly prevalent presence on social media, but if people want to get in touch with you or keep up with your work, where can we direct them?
Probably the easiest thing would be email. No, I'm not, you won't find me on social media. Email would be stonem@etsu.edu would be the easiest way to get in touch with me.
It's probably worth mentioning, Josh, the Center for Sports Science and Coach Education at ETSU, they do have social media. There's a Twitter and an Instagram.
Okay, awesome. And then that'll kind of lead people to Dr. Stone, and they can obviously check out ResearchGate and look at the profile. There's a lot of research on there that they can either look at or request access to. And then Dr. Pierce, where can we direct people if they want to get in touch with you or keep up with your work?
Just email would be the best, I guess. So I'd be glad to, if I don't have the answers, I don't have a lot of the answers, I'd be glad to direct somebody to somebody that does. And you know, we have people that come visit us on occasions here. We're a free program for local kids. And all they have to do is join USA Weightlifting, and otherwise it's free, and we're free for coaches that want to come and talk, and I'm happy to help in any way that I may be able to.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And then, Guy, I'm sure you're going to have a little bit more of an extended answer for this one, but if people want to keep up with you, your work, West Virginia Weightlifting, where can we direct them?
I'm on ResearchGate and West Virginia Weightlifting. That's the name of the Instagram page. We have the club has a page, and then I am Coach Guyton on that's my Twitter handle.
Okay, awesome. And if people want to keep up with me, you can follow me on Instagram @Josh_PhilWL. That's PhilWL. You can shoot me a message on there. You can reach out to me in any other way, and I'll try and get back to you. But Thanks again for everyone listening. If you really enjoyed the podcast, feel free to share it around. Feel free to use it as a resource. And also feel free to contact any of these gentlemen if you see fit and you have questions that are kind of burning after listening to this episode. And with that being said, we will catch you all on another episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast.